Hello, and welcome to Securing Sexuality, the podcast where we discuss the intersection of intimacy
and information security. I'm Wolf Gorlick.
He's a hacker, and I'm Stephanie Gorlick.
She is a sex therapist, and together we're going to discuss what safe sex looks like in a digital age. So, something happened recently in my world that has me thinking about our work. Yeah.
I mean, that's a little scary. What could possibly happen in your world that makes you think of our world? Usually those two stay pretty far apart.
Have you heard of Microsoft Copilot?
I have, because I know is that I'm convinced I'm never going to buy another computer because I'm going to hit the Copilot button and fuckery is going to ensue, and I don't want that.
Well, yes, that would be a problem. Also, apparently, it's been blocked in the government. That came out today.
I mean, that makes sense, because I think we had had, you and I have had conversations with other people that were dealing with government employees that were genuinely surprised that they couldn't, like, use ChatGPT to do their federal budget paperwork and stuff like that. I mean, this has been an ongoing issue with the government, I hear.
And Grammarly. So, yeah, the U.S. House of Representatives banned staffers' use of Copilot this week. But also, when I'm having conversations, right? So what happens is in my world is something changes, technology changes, and then all the security people trying to figure out what that change means. Sometimes we're ahead of it, but oftentimes we are, as a good friend of mine once said, the way you keep up is by being two steps behind. So we're sometimes a little bit behind. But one of the things that I keep talking about with Copilot is it's not necessarily a big risk because it's reading the data you already have. But the risk is the prompts you put into it, right? Like if you're asking for certain things, those things that are being asked for are recorded, and sometimes they're aggregated, and sometimes they're analyzed. It's a very similar story to what we've talked about in terms of search results, what people can tell from people's search results.
Okay. And that can be a lot. I remember back in the day that like Target's algorithm was able to predict pregnancy based on what people were searching for and buying online, even when they didn't know they were pregnant yet themselves. So I know that, you know, that has been an ongoing thing, that the information we search for tells a lot about us without us thinking about it.
Right, right. And that got me thinking about our world. And we've had conversations before about how people's private lives oftentimes are private. They want to keep it private, right? For a variety of different reasons. For the people who they love, for the relationships that they maintain, for the private urges they may have. I am way over my skis here. Add more psychological content as appropriate.
So, Copilot, not a great idea is what I'm hearing. What I think where you're going with this is that this is going to lead to, as I mentioned early, fuckery ensuing.
Well, it's more than just Copilot. It's all the AI tools that have come up and how wickedly good they are becoming at determining things that we would rather keep private and internal.
So what would that look like? Because I very rarely, if ever, use ChatGPT. I don't like the AIs. I think they're creepy. But I do know that they're called learning models, right? Language learning models. Do I have that right?
Pretty close. You have the right words. Wrong order.
Okay. But learning is in the name. So clearly they're good at learning things from us. Otherwise, maybe that wouldn't be in the name. Maybe it would be language observing models. So what are they learning about us? What can AI tell about me?
Well, it's actually large language model. And part of the problem is we don't really know what they can tell. So I wanted to take a slice of all the possible things that we may want to keep private from a securing sexuality perspective. And, you know, throw some out at me. What would you think people would want to keep private?
Well, I'm a sex therapist, so let's go with sexy things. They don't want their intimate information shared. They don't want photos or fantasies shared, I would assume.
Yeah, and they don't want probably what they're into, their orientation, those sort of things. Now, as you might imagine, most of that is really hard to answer from a research perspective, as I think you ran into a couple times when you tried to do research and like do surveys I remember some of the kink community has kind of got up in arms when you were asking them questions.
I mean, what I always say is that nobody wants to feel like they're the gorillas and Jane Goodall's like staring at them in the bushes, right? Like, that's not a comfortable feeling for anybody. So yeah, a lot of minority groups, whether they're erotic minorities or gender or sexual minorities, they're not huge fans of personal disclosure in that way, because we have a long history of personal private information being weaponized against people. Right before you and I sat down to record this, I was working on a book chapter for some colleagues of mine that focuses just on that, on the way that people's identities have been perceived and punished at times over the years. So it makes a lot of sense to me that people want their private stuff to remain private.
So I'm going to broaden out the conversation, share with you what I've been looking at, and I'm also going to narrow it down. I'm going to broaden it out to say any machine learning, right, regardless of copilots or ChatGPT, the generative AI side versus traditional machine learning analytics, any AI model, I'm going to broaden out that way. But to get some good like research on this, I really had to narrow it down. And so the one I picked was sexual orientation. So if you did not want to be outed by your search history, by what have you, I picked sexual orientation because there's a lot of good research on that topic.
Okay. And what did you find? What did you learn?
Well, it is surprisingly easy. Not what I was hoping. First off, if you just look at like what we're plugging into search engines, and this is important because remember, whenever you're plugging it into ChatGPT or any of these other Copilot or any of these other ones that are wired up to the internet, they will do internet searches for you. So that search history may be captured in the internet search, or it also just may be captured in the prompts that you're feeding into the AI systems. So I found a lot of research saying that, yeah, indeed, and of course we sort of knew this from the Pornhub conversation, indeed, you can tell a lot about what people are fantasizing about or thinking about or planning or imagining by the prompts that they either put into Google, being ChatGPT or Microsoft Copilot or. Although I would argue, and this is not based on any data, but I would expect Copilot's probably pretty low on that because it's seen as a work tool as opposed to some of these other ones. But yeah, it's very quickly possible to determine sexual orientation from those conversations.
So how? I mean, I get if somebody were saying, I don't know, if I were using ChatGPT to create a sexy story of, I don't know, GPT erotica of me and another girl, I could see how that might lead the machine learning system to be like, well, clearly this is something Stephanie has thoughts about and learning from there. But if somebody's using it for non-explicit or non-really specific things, how is that information being aggregated?
There's also patterns in the way people frame sentences, the word choices they use, the paragraphs that they use, just our way of communicating that can convey some of these things that can be correlated with some of these things. Not with a great degree of accuracy, but with a reasonably better than a coin flip degree of accuracy.
So that is fascinating to me because, you know, in my world, we talk about the unique individuality of every person. And we push back hard on the idea of stereotypes or tells that might give away somebody's gender or sexual orientation or any number of other variables, their kink identity. How is their use of language, how is the way that a sentence is created or written giving that information up? And how do we know that it's accurate? I mean, I suppose you're telling me it's better than 50-50, but that still is mind-blowing to me. I wouldn't think that somebody's sexual orientation could be inferred from their sentence structure.
It's similar to code switching, and we've talked about code switching in the past. You were telling me about that. Do you want to give like a brief definition of code switching?
Yeah. So code switching is when somebody has multiple identities and they change their use of language, perhaps their physical presentation or their body mannerisms in different social contexts. So somebody that is, let's say, a very conservative Catholic who's also kink identified is going to look and dress and speak and behave very differently if they are at mass talking to their priest versus if they are at a play party with their spouse. The slang that they'll use, the posture or body language, all sorts of things come into play where they, I don't want to say put on and take off a persona because these are all parts of who they authentically are, but where they're really leaning into one aspect of their identity more than another in a given time or place.
And that works because there are certain touchstones, certain aspects that a community shares that by reflecting those, communicating those, wearing those, you communicate that you are part of that community, right? And so there's a bit of trust building involved with that, but there's also means that there are certain linguistic patterns that are particular to specific communities. So if you pick up on those patterns, you can say this person is probably part of that community. And if they're probably part of that community, they probably share certain other aspects consistent with that community.
Right, so not going to lie, that's creepy.
Oh, it gets even more creepy. Let's talk about something you said there. Of course, she says. Sometimes I feel like I bring us more and more down the creep rabbit hole whenever we talk.
I mean, that's kind of the nature of this work, right? We're not doing the let's be enthusiastic about sexual expression on the internet podcast. We're doing the how can we be more secure with our sexuality podcast. And when we're talking about being secure, that means talking about vulnerabilities. And that often means that we have some really depressing conversations.
Well, I like the science, although it may not be depressing. How about lifting it up a little bit in terms of levity? Do you remember that word we used to say in the 90s when someone had radar for homosexuality?
Gaydar.
Gaydar. Well, there was a study called Gaydar. I'm not just bringing that up just to bring that up. There's a study called Gaydar that was done about a decade ago by Jerrigan and Mystery. And what they found was intriguing. This gets back to this idea of in-groups and out-groups. They were actually able to determine someone's sexual orientation by their Facebook friend map.
Okay, so that actually makes a little bit of sense to me.
Oh, okay. Tell me more.
Well, because we tend to be friends within our social circle, and we tend to have a social circle that represents our interests, our values, our identities. If I am super into ice hockey, even if I never talk about ice hockey or post about ice hockey, I suspect an algorithm would look at my Facebook friends and go, oh, wow, 80% of her Facebook friends are super into ice hockey. And that becomes a logical inference.
I could see that. I could see that. But in the past, back to being creepy, in the past, your friends weren't necessarily on a social graph that could be queried by an API and analyzed and compared against other sets of data.
Okay. You used a whole bunch of technical words that I don't know that I know. What's API? I know we have a friend, Rachel Arnold, who spoke at our conference, who calls herself the human API. But I'm going to be honest, I just thought that meant human API, and I didn't know what API went. Apiary? Maybe she was into beekeeping? I don't know. What's an API?
You are adorable. API is the programmatic interface that software uses to communicate with the web, right? So the UI the user interface is the web page, and we could go to Facebook and we could browse your friends. The API delivers the same information, but in a machine readable format. So my point is, in the past, like if we go back to, again, when the term GADAR came out, you didn't necessarily know your friends' friends, right? You had an idea of who they hung out with, maybe if you see them. You certainly didn't know like two or three connections away from you, because you almost never saw those folks. And so it wasn't necessarily something that was immediately applicable and available to you through a user interface. And moreover, it wasn't something that you could just pull down into one of these machine learning tools or one of these deep learning tools and do an analysis on and say, hey, what does their friends tell them about them?
Okay, I don't like that. I don't like anything about that.
It also makes me wonder what our friend circle tells us about us. I friend just about anyone who friends me, so I don't know what that would say about me.
And I don't. I keep my social media world really small. That was, you know, when I first started pitching with sprinkles on top, that I was told was going to be a barrier, that I didn't have a huge social media following. And that's not a priority for me. I don't want 50,000 people knowing what you and I are doing on vacation. I don't need 500 people giving me their opinions of, I don't know, literally anything, frankly. So I can see how, you know, the sort of influencer people, the people with major following, it becomes harder to kind of pin down who they are as a person. Because like you said, you just let anybody that wants to follow you, follow you. Does that mean that if my data set is smaller, it's actually more accurate because it's more curated?
It could be. Yeah, I would imagine your signal to noise ratio is a lot higher than mine because you've got fewer people and have been more conscientious about your connections. So we could probably tell all sorts of stuff about you from your friends.
So what do we do with this? Because right. I don't like it.
Let me tell you. Let's suppose, because it just gets more fun. Let's suppose you and I have had this conversation. You say, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to set my Facebook to private, or I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to expose my friend circle. I'm going to set it to private. No one can read anything. No one can see anything. The only thing you're going to have is what's publicly available. When I think your Facebook was private for a while, or maybe still is. When it's set to private, what can people see?
From what I understand, they can see my profile picture and my name. And I think maybe in my hometown, if I have that listed.
All right. So how about this? And again, I'm just sticking with a very narrow problem space, right? We want to know if someone is on the binary, and I know anyone who's listening to this recognizes there's no binary, but on the binary between either straight or homosexual, and all I have is a name and a photo. I tell you what, I'll make it easier. Don't even give me the name. I found three different studies that could predict someone's sexual orientation from a facial picture alone with accuracy from anywhere from 70% to 92%.
How? Why? That doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't. It doesn't at all. But so, they're using... Oh, go ahead.
I used to know somebody who was convinced that gay cheekbones were a thing.
Oh.
And this was not, you know, somebody that was bigoted or homophobic. They were actually, you know, gay themselves. But they felt very strongly, and they had a pretty good degree of accuracy in terms of, you know, what I observed in our friendship, of whenever somebody had like really sharp, chiseled, well-defined cheekbones, that was a tell for them that that person, if they were male, was probably gay. Now, listeners, please do not come after me for sharing this story. I'm not saying I agree with it. I'm not saying there's anything behind it. I am only sharing this to say, is that what's happening in these pictures? Are there physiological tells that an AI is able to pick up? Because that feels uncomfortably close to some sort of tech eugenics to me.
So what was the rate in which she was successful, or he was? Was it high? Was it low?
I wasn't keeping score, obviously. We know how I am with statistics, but I would say right more often than not. If I had to ballpark it, I would say 65 to 80% accuracy.
So in one of the studies they found, they tested humans and people were able to guess, on average, 60% correct. So your 65 to 70 is probably right in the mix.
Okay.
And when they ran those same photos through AI, they raised that, in this particular study, up to 70%. So yeah, there does seem to be some facial commonalities. Now, again, I want to be very clear. I don't want to go back to, like, was it craniometry? The study of, like, people's skulls to determine if they're deviant or not?
Phrenology.
We're not going to go down those roads. But I don't know. Maybe it's something about the pose you take. Maybe it's something about the filter you use. Maybe it's you've got good skin. I don't know. I got terrible skin and I'm straight. So I'm going to say anyone who's straight listening to this probably has terrible skin. And now people come after me. But this is part of the problem with any of these AI models. Problem number one is a lot of what we put into our questions, our queries, a lot of what we do in terms of relating to friends and making connections, a lot of what we do in terms of putting photos out there and doing those sort of things, we do in a conscious and unconscious way that can sometimes expose data we don't want to. That's problem number one. Problem number two is you may be wondering, what did they look at? Was it the cheekbones? Was it the filter? Was it the pose? We don't know. And that's what always concerns me about deep learning models, is that it's truly a black box. We don't really know what they're using to make these decisions.
Okay, I know I've said this twice already, but I don't like this. This is creepy. This is uncomfortable. This is intrusive. I have learned in our time doing this project together not to ask, well, what can we do about it? Because whenever it comes to AI, the answer seems to always be nothing. But maybe I'm going to cross my fingers. Maybe this time I'm wrong. What can we do about it?
Well, for one, I think it is being conscientious of what we put out there. When I was talking about code switching, especially the very easy thing you can do right now, if you're Google searching or if you're using any of these AIs, is, you know, do your own form of code switching and be very bland and very careful about what you put into these machines. Although I'll tell you that kind of makes me sad that you have to, like, mask parts of your personality to not show things you don't want to show.
And how would you even know what not to show? I mean, it doesn't seem like we are really clear on how the algorithms are making these determinations. So how would somebody know what not to post or what not to, I don't know, what filter not to use?
Yeah, we don't know. We don't know. It may be, we may get to a point where there's some of these things exposed that can tell you, which, by the way, is one of the things that we can do, right? So some of the rules that have already been put out for data aggregation and data miners against advertising is you have to disclose what the algorithm has decided about you. So I'd encourage you to take a look at that and be aware of it. And I encourage you to support those laws that make it easy to find out that information. So that would be one. The other thing is, what are we doing with this information, right? So maybe it's okay that we can determine someone's preferences by their friend circles or what they type into chat or their pictures. It's creepy, but maybe it's okay. It becomes very much less okay when that's used for insurance purposes. Or when it's used for policing, right? Like I want to take police action against a certain set of people. And so one of the things that's happening right now in the European Union, and again, the European Union tends to be ahead of us on all things privacy and, you know, protective legalities, is they've released their law around artificial intelligence. And their law basically says that there are a list of unacceptable uses for this technology, right? So, well, you may be able to determine these sort of things using them for workplace hiring and firing decisions, for example, would be illegal if you're in Europe.
I mean, that's great, but how would anybody possibly prove that?
I don't know. We'll have to see the first case that goes through. I'd imagine because you're going to have someone who's, if it was to happen, you'd have someone who was communicating over comms and saying, hey, by the way, we're using this new app to pre-filter the people who put in resumes, right? I mean, it's going to leave a trail like everything else we do.
So, but it's going to be something where there's an internal leak, effectively, whether it's a whistleblower or just something gets out and is made public. It's not something that a candidate or a suspect would know about before that.
Correct. Correct.
So on one hand, good. I'm glad that they're putting those laws in place. On the other hand, other than scale, like the efficacy and volume, how is that any different than what a lot of HR departments do already? And go and look at somebody's profile and say, oh, they graduated college 20 years ago, or oh, they have gray hair, or oh, I see that they're using a mobility aid in their vacation photos, and use those pictures to make discriminatory decisions.
I'm a technologist, not a lawyer. and I'm a technologist, not a human resources person. I don't know how that's any different. But you're asking me, you know, certain things that can be done. And one is, I think, you know, continue to push for laws. And two is to be conscientious of the risk when you're interacting with these tools.
That's what I think is sad, though, is that what we're calling risk in this conversation is just somebody's identity. It's just who they are. It shouldn't be a risk to be publicly queer on social media. It shouldn't be a risk for your profile picture to have your wheelchair in it. It shouldn't be a risk for your high school graduation date to be listed in your Facebook stats. And yet, people face discrimination for these and so many other things all the time. This is not really a new problem. It's just doing what technology always does and making old problems more efficient.
That is so well said. One of the things, you know, I mentioned at the top of this episode is I'm having a lot of conversations with organizations that are adopting Microsoft Copilot right now. And again, this is not an episode about Copilot. We talked about a lot of different research. None of that directly ties to Copilot, but that was what started me thinking about this. And one of the things I consistently say about Copilot is, the problems we're talking about are not new problems. These are problems that consisted and persisted in your environment predating Copilot. But the minute you adopt new technology that accelerates our ability to find and consume information, we also are accelerating our ability to make mistakes. We're scaling our ability to make mistakes. And so I think what you just said there is really critical. When we have these moments of inflection where a new technology appears, we bring with it, you know, all these old biases, all these old problems that our society has, and then amplify and speed them up.
And you've already emphatically stated this is not a Copilot conversation, but a thing that bothers me about that level of integration of AI, where, hey, it's got its own button on the laptop now, it's there whether you asked for this feature or not, is that like so many other of these technologies, the default setting is often on. And I don't know that I feel comfortable with any AI living in my device. How do I know that any device of mine that has AI capacity is ever actually off? How can I ever know that I have thoroughly and completely opted out? Or is there always the risk moving forward that some algorithm somewhere in my devices is capturing data about me?
Well, there's always devices all over the place capturing all sorts of data about us. So first off, I think it's imperative to know that that is a risk no matter what we do going forward. Secondly, we can mitigate that risk, as I was mentioning, with work through groups like the EFF, with pushing for better laws, making sure that people are not misusing that information. Thirdly, to your point, you know, it's important to set up a point in time to review your settings. You remember last year I did that whole like press tour talking about cybersecurity New Year's resolutions. And one of them was put some time aside to check all the settings of all your devices and all your apps for anything that's new appeared, for anything that's privacy focusing, and turn off things that you're not using and turn on anything that's available for privacy. So I think that is also important just to keep on top of how things are evolving.
Okay. I don't know that that makes me feel any better, but it's something. It's what we've got. So where do we go from here?
To an outro.
All right. Well, you haven't made me feel any better, so give me some comforting words as we wrap this up. Tell me, I don't know, how can this make my life better? Can AI ever be used to find me in ways that are positive? Can AI ever be like her? She's awesome.
Yeah, of course. That's the whole point. AI will find us better, faster. It's search on steroids in terms of what we've been talking about here today. So yeah, absolutely. I think that's accurate. You know, we are taking out things which have historically. Just a second. We are taking things which historically have been made by people, your friend who are like, I look for cheekbones, right? And we know all the problems with human biases. There is certainly something to be said for moving from a day and age where we're reliant heavily on human biases towards systems, towards reliability, towards automation. So I think there are absolutely some benefits in terms of our reach, in terms of our speed, and in terms of our accuracy, and in terms of removing the human bias. And I also think just having these conversations is a good thing, right? Because it forces us to evaluate our own biases and think about what a world would look like as we move into these new technologies. And if we don't have these conversations now and explore these topics early, you know, as we've learned from a lot of different innovations, it's already built by the time we go, wait a minute, what's it being used for? So I do think it's a good thing that these conversations are happening. And I think that, we have a moment in time where we can inject some change.
I am here for change. I think I'm not here for all the change that's happening right now, but I'm definitely here for change and sometimes for some change of those changes. But for now, you've given me something to think about, and maybe I delete my profiles. Will deleting my social media actually help with any of this if I did it?
I mean, yes.
I probably won't, but it's a fun threat we all like to make these days, right?
Yes. If things get any worse, we're all moving to Canada, and if this keeps happening, we're all deleting our social media accounts.
And in the meantime, we're all listening to podcasts, so thank you so much for tuning in to Securing Sexuality, your source for the information you need to protect yourself and your relationships.
Securing Sexuality is brought to you by the Bound Together Foundation, a 501c3 nonprofit. In the bedroom to the cloud, we're here to help you navigate safe sex in the digital age.
Be sure to check out our website, securingsexuality.com, for links to more information about everything we've discussed here today, as well as our upcoming live events.
And join us here again for more fascinating conversations about the intersection of sexuality and technology. Have a great week.